some people who are going to be in and out because they have some conflicting meetings, but we'll just work around that. So for the Pledge of Allegiance, Carol, would you please lead us?
Yes, would you please stand and say the pledge with me? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Carol. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, good morning. Could you do the roll call for us?
Okay, Tony Olivato.
Here.
Elizabeth Busick here. Carol Downey.
Here.
Scott Fake. Nalita Mendoza. Nalita?
I'm here. Present.
Okay. All right. Elaine Genoway.
Present.
Sherry Horn. Larry Kramer.
Here, but as I said, I'll be leaving at 11:15 today.
11:15, uh-huh. Jim Levy.
Here.
John Pointer.
Here.
Tony Rodella.
Here.
Dave Tetzloff. And Evelyn Velez.
Here.
Okay. And Elizabeth, Sherry joined right after you called her name.
Oh.
Sherry Horn.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
And we have a quorum.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't see Gina Sergio, OCCS.
Yeah, she's our staff support.
Okay. I don't see any other introductions other than our speaker. And Elaine, if you wouldn't mind, please introducing our speaker for the day.
Okay, I will be happy to. So today's speaker is Senator Pat Bates' office. We had invited the senator and she is in a committee meeting this morning. But Senator Bates has served as an elected representative of Orange County residents since first elected to the Laguna Niguel City Council in 1989. She has also served as a member of the Assembly, a member of the Board of Supervisors, and in 2014, she was elected to serve as the Senator for the 36th District in the California State Senate. She represents over 1 million people living in South Orange and North San Diego counties. As I said, she is in a committee meeting this morning, so we are fortunate to have her Chief of Staff, Kevin Bassett, here to represent Senator Bates. Kevin previously served on the staff of the late Senator Dave Cox for over 18 years. His extensive experience in state and local government includes service as the chief of staff to several offices and as the alternate on the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency Board, the Sacramento Public Library Authority Board, the Sacramento Metropolitan Cable Commission Board, and the governing board for the Area 4 Agency on Aging, where he served as the agency's treasurer and auditor. Kevin earned his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California at Davis and a master's degree in public administration from the University of Southern California. He resides in Gold River with his wife, Susan, and their children, Jack and Kara. So please welcome Kevin Bassett.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
It's good to be with everyone this morning, and I'm honored to be here on behalf of Senator Bates with the Orange County Senior Citizens Advisory Council and your Ledge Committee. Senator Bates is here in Sacramento this morning, and as Councilmember Genoway noted, she's in committee this morning. The unique challenge that we have is she has two committees going on simultaneously, both starting at 9 a.m. She is the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee that is meeting at 9, and then she's a member of the Senate Business and Professions Committee, which started promptly at 9 a.m. this morning, where she also has one of her own bills up. So today's a busy day. The Senate meets at 2 p.m. today after those committee hearings adjourn. So Mondays at this time of year can get a little chaotic. Before I touch on state budget and pending legislation, I'd like you to imagine a scenario with me. You wake up in the morning, you're still very tired and you're feeling a little bit sluggish. You check your smartwatch to look at the sleep report. While making your breakfast, you take an electrocardiogram from the medical grade EKG monitor you received because heart disease runs in your family. You double check the reading. It still says abnormal. You open the patient portal app on your phone and schedule a virtual visit for later in the morning with your doctor. You use the restroom, which happens to have a smart toilet that scans stool and urine for health data. You visit with your doctor later in the morning. It lasts about 20 minutes, which you use your smartphone to interact with the doctor. The doctor guides you through a routine exam using a digital device with a stethoscope extension, and you discuss the EKG report. The doctor is going to do an e-consult with a specialist and will send you a message this afternoon to let you know if you need to come in for further tests. This hypothetical situation, outlined in much more detail in an article by Eva Rothler in Comstock's magazine titled Connected Care, is not as futuristic as it sounds. While the smart toilet is a prototype, all of the technology that I just outlined exists now and is part of a rapidly growing mode of healthcare known as telehealth or telemedicine. And while telehealth has been bogged down for years in red tape with a complicated patchwork of regulation at all levels of government, many are saying that the COVID pandemic has demystified and democratized the digital health and made it more accessible to physicians and patients like never before. Some of this is due to the many waivers that have been approved at the federal and state levels to address the challenges created by COVID. And on that note, there's some good news in the governor's budget. It includes about $34 million in the general fund within Medi-Cal to expand certain telehealth modalities put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. The governor is also proposing budget trailer bill language to make these telehealth flexibilities permanent in order to better improve access to Medi-Cal providers. At the end of 2020, Assemblymember Aguiar-Curry introduced AB 32, seeking to make current telehealth flexibilities permanent under state law. There's no way around this. The country is being forced to reassess how and where healthcare is delivered. You noted that I'm a UC Davis graduate, and UC Davis Health advises that in 2019, they held 1,200 video visits. In 2020, UC Davis Health conducted 132,400 video visits. This is a year-over-year increase over 10,000%. Things are changing. Many believe the power of telehealth advancements will increase access to care for some patients. One major issue is going to be whether it will widen gaps in existing disparities. And for seniors, this is a very real issue. Adults over 65 represent a disproportionate percentage of healthcare spending relative to the size of population. Yet they are the group least likely to describe themselves as digitally ready. And so the challenge for all of us is, how do we address access? How do we address equity? And how do we do these things while still moving forward with these advancements that have the capacity to help so many people? I briefly mentioned the governor's budget, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on it at this point. The governor released his budget on January 8th. Justice and Aging called it a good first step towards ensuring health, safety, and well-being of older Californians. The budget picture in January looked dramatically better than it did just 7 months prior. California tax revenues, which are heavily reliant on higher income earners, have shown to be less affected by COVID-19 and the government's response than anyone expected. The governor's budget from January estimates that $15 billion in one-time discretionary revenues are available to spend. Also in January, the Legislative Analyst Office estimated that that one-time revenue number was $26 billion. We are hearing today that that number might even be higher than that $26 billion LAO estimate. The governor appropriately called for early legislative votes to approve certain proposals, including school assistance and economic stimulus to address the COVID crisis. However, some of the details in the governor's other early spending proposals seem to be a little bit misguided. There are no investments to fix the embattled Economic Development Department, for example, but the governor does propose to borrow $1 billion for zero emission vehicle subsidies, even though we're looking at a $15 to $26 billion surplus. Despite the short-term revenue surprise, rapid spending increases prior to the pandemic had already put the state on the verge of operating deficits. Expenditures continue to grow faster than revenues in the forecast for at least the next several years, and the governor's budget predicts operating deficits to grow to more than $11 billion by 2024 and 2025. But there is some good news, and on a brighter note, the state's rainy day fund that the voters put in place in 2014 through Proposition 2 is projected to reach $15.5 billion by the end of 2021-2022. And the governor's budget also includes a discretionary reserve of nearly $2.9 billion, a safety net reserve of $450 million, and a public school reserve of $3 billion, which would bring total reserves to $21.9 billion when combined with the rainy day fund. And that number will rise a little bit as we look at those one-time funds, because as the revenues go up, the rainy day reserve goes up because we set aside more money. The governor was asking the legislature to approve two groups of proposals faster than normal, called an immediate action package in January and an early action package in March. The immediate action package totaled about $5 billion in January to respond quickly to the pandemic's effects on schools and businesses. $2 billion to assist schools with reopening efforts, $2.4 billion for stimulus efforts, such as $600 payments each for people who received the earned income tax credits, and that was ultimately expanded to SSI recipients as well as CalWORKs recipients. And the governor originally proposed $575 million for grants for businesses and nonprofits, and thankfully the legislature and the governor worked to push that number up to $2.6 billion to help California small businesses. The early action package for March totaled more than $6.5 billion for various proposals, many worthy, but some didn't exactly appear to be tied to COVID-19. There was almost $5 billion in Prop 98 money to address learning loss, $973 million for various jobs and workplace training efforts, $561 million for environmental sustainability, $50 million for county probation departments, and $100 million to support emergency student financial aid, and then $20 million to bolster community college student retention and recruitment. So while the whole mantra was to focus on COVID, you can see that some other things kind of snuck into that early action package that we did in March. The governor's budget proposal also includes some items specifically of interest to seniors. It includes investments in Alzheimer's disease and geriatric care workforce development. The governor's budget includes $3 million in one-time general fund dollars to increase and diversify the pipeline of senior caregivers through student loan repayment and other incentives in exchange for a geriatric-focused service obligation. And so if they take the money, they'll have to serve in that discipline, which makes sense, and that will help expand our workforce. The budget also includes $17 million in one-time general fund to further Alzheimer's disease efforts, including disease research, a public awareness campaign, new caregiver training, and grants to cities that plan to make dementia-friendly environmental changes. And so you may want to be looking at that on how to access some of those dollars specifically for Orange County in the coming months. There's also funding to house vulnerable older adults. The budget allocates $250 million for local governments to purchase or rehabilitate adult residential facilities and residential care facilities for the elderly, for older adults who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. These funds can be used for capital improvements and upgrades for existing care facilities. In the area of in-home support services, which is a Medi-Cal benefit that I know you're aware of, that provides personal care and domestic services to a projected 592,829 aged, blind, or disabled Californians. In over 70% of the cases, recipients choose family members to be their paid service providers. The governor's budget includes $16.5 billion, $5.3 billion from the general fund, for the IHSS program, a 10% increase from the revised 2020 budget amount. it continues to be one of the state's fastest growing programs, both in terms of caseload and program cost. Included in the budget is an adjustment for $1.2 billion to fund the minimum wage increases that resulted in the minimum wage legislation passed in 2015. The budget also defers cuts to several human services programs, including the trigger cuts to, we'll move the trigger cuts that included a 7% across the board cut to IHSS hours. It defers those cuts to 2022. The budget also reflects current year costs of about $40 million to fund the federally required 80 hours of sick leave for any public employee to recover or care from a family member with COVID-19. In the human services realm, this federal requirement primarily affects IHSS employees. And to help those employees and the IHSS consumers, the budget provides $6.7 million in 2020 and 2021, and $3.3 million total funds in 2021-22 to provide a temporary per hour wage increase of $2 to IHSS backup providers. The wage differential was provided as an incentive to quickly attract a backup caregiver in the event that a primary caregiver contracted or otherwise had to care for family members with COVID-19. So not surprisingly, COVID's impacting every sector, but if you're a caregiver and you get impacted, then we have the ability to bring in these backup caregivers. And so this seems like a smart investment to help make sure that those services continue in those in the households that rely on IHSS. I know you're all very aware of the master plan, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the funding provisions that will back up the master plan. The master plan is a comprehensive framework that will prepare the state for significant demographic changes in the years ahead, including the growth of the 60 and over population to 10.8 million people by 2030. That's just a staggering number and growing very quickly. It serves as a blueprint for state government, local communities, private organizations, and philanthropy to promote an age-friendly California. It includes 132 initiatives addressing 5 bold goals for 2030. And I know that you've seen and looked at that. It's housing for all ages and stages, health reimagined, which is going to help with access so that we can live in our homes and our communities and optimize our quality of life. Inclusion and equity, not isolation, so that we have lifelong opportunities for work, volunteering, engagement, and leadership that will be protected from isolation, discrimination, abuse, and neglect. The fourth pillar is caregiving that works. Will be prepared for and supported through the rewards and challenges of caring for aging loved ones. And then the fifth pillar is affording aging. We'll have economic security for as long as we live. And the target there is to close the equity gap and increase elder economic sufficiency. And we talked a little bit about that as we talked about the telehealth aspect, that closing that equity gap and that accessibility gap is essential for the senior population. But one thing you may not have focused on the master plan is it includes the creation of a local playbook to help develop local aging initiatives and an aging data dashboard that tracks the state's progress on the implementation of the master plan. So this gives all of you an opportunity and the County of Orange an opportunity to really focus in on how can we advance the interests of Orange County seniors. Specifically, the governor proposes the following investments to tie to the master plan for aging. He calls for the appointment of a senior advisor on aging, disability, and Alzheimer's to advance cross-cabinet initiatives and partnerships. This type of cabinet-level position was a recommendation of the Master Plan for Aging's Long-Term Services and Support Subcommittee. The goal is to help provide leadership across agencies and departments. And you know the state of California governance system being just massive. We have these massive pillars that go with that. And so having this cross-cabinet coordination can be really beneficial, can help seniors at all levels, but can really help taxpayers too, because we can make sure that we're using all of the different departments and agencies in sync as opposed to in isolation. There's also $5 million in the general fund master plan for aging implementation funds. These funds are earmarked for implementation of proposals that will be released later in the spring. And the Senate's budget sub 3 is gonna meet in a couple of weeks to look in more detail at this. It looks like the funding is going to be used to support about 20 positions in the Department of Aging, and resources to implement the master plan through policy, technology, data, project management, and support. The scenario that I walked you through earlier on the telehealth really relies on broadband. And the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed California's digital divide. And according to California Public Utilities Commission, an annual report done in 2019 on the California Advanced Services Fund, which is a tax we all pay on our cell phones to fund broadband as well as some telephone services, 33% of rural households do not have access to high-speed broadband at what's known as the 25 megabits per second download speed and 3 megabytes per second upload speeds, which in the industry is noted as 25.3 megabytes. In contrast, 97.9% of households in urban areas have access at that speed. In total, though, there's more than 490,000 households are unserved at the 25.3 megabyte per second level. However, these speeds are not meeting the needs of Californians today, many of whom are working from home, distance learning, or utilizing telehealth services. And so we've got a lot of work to do in this area. The existing state efforts to close the digital divide, for California, we've long recognized the need for broadband access. In 2008, California began taxing telephone consumers, as I had noted, to subsidize broadband infrastructure in areas that were otherwise cost prohibitive for private companies to install broadband. Since the program's inception in 2008, $645 million has been budgeted for expanding broadband service with the goal of providing service to 98% of households in each specified region of the state by the end of 2022. It's abundantly apparent that the program has not kept pace with the needs of Californians, especially rural Californians, and the program and related funding stream is set to expire at the end of 2022. So broadband is a very popular and timely issue in the California State Legislature. For example, more than one third of Californians without access to broadband do not have a subscription service. Not only is the service often expensive, but the devices required to use those services are expensive as well. And so we have communities that don't have broadband to their household, and then we have households that have that broadband that get to their doorstep, but they haven't subscribed to that broadband. And that can be for any number of reasons, but price is often the key component. In addition to state efforts, the federal government recently approved a COVID-19 relief bill, HR 133, that provides $7 billion for broadband access assistance nationwide. And that's in a variety of areas. The federal government also established the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund to award up to $20.4 billion nationally to support broadband infrastructure deployment and network operations over a 10-year period. Funds are awarded for eligible areas around the country that lack broadband service. So you can see there's going to be a flood of federal dollars coming in due to the COVID relief package, as well as the previously passed Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. And so California really needs to focus on how do we draw in those federal dollars. We'll get a reasonable share just based on population, but if we have good projects, then we have the ability to draw down more of those federal dollars. The governor's budget and his policy agenda right now doesn't include a specific proposal in the budget to provide additional funding to close that digital divide. The governor calls for a coordinated state effort over the next 5 years with collaboration between state, federal, local governments, regional agencies, Native American tribes, and the private sector and the public. With one-time general fund revenues of $15 billion to $26 billion available and immediate needs for broadband access, a one-time expenditure on broadband infrastructure and access, we believe would be a prudent use of those funds. A significant contribution now would significantly help with distance learning, telework, and telehealth needs now and into the future. And that leads me to some of the bills that Senator Bates is working on, because one of them is a broadband infrastructure investment bill. Her SB 732 is focused on broadband development and accessibility. It would provide for a $5 billion appropriation this year for broadband deployment from the one-time surge in revenues, and also provide $1 billion per year for the following 5 years. In addition to focusing on deployment, it would also provide for vouchers for low-income households with students on the free and reduced lunch program so that they have the needed broadband capacity to participate in school. You've all read and heard the stories about students in their households, wherever that may be, that are lacking that broadband access, and it's pushing them even further behind. And so the thought process here is because 97% of urban households have broadband to the doorstep, can we help subsidize that at least through the end of COVID so that we can make sure those households have that access? And we didn't want to spend a lot of time focused on who was eligible and how to determine eligibility. We took the existing free lunch program that the Department of Education already administers and said, if you're already eligible for that, then you're eligible for this broadband voucher. And so we hope to have that bill heard in the coming days. There are other bills by other legislators. One of them is a $10 billion bond proposal. So you can see how we came up with $5 billion upfront and $1 billion over five for the next 5 years, because we really don't believe that you need to do this by a bond at this point, given the revenue structure for the state. There's another bill that would extend the existing tax in order to fund broadband services. And there are others that are very meritorious that will help clear out some of the hurdles to get broadband into underserved communities, be them rural or urban or suburban. Senator Bates's perspective is we should invest money now and have the focus on actually getting projects built with some accountability. She has another bill to deal with insulin. Her SB 473 caps co-pays, deductibles, and co-insurance and other cost-sharing requirements on an insulin prescription to $50 per 30-day supply and no more than $100 total per month. People with type 1 diabetes and some with type 2 diabetes must have insulin to live, but price increases for those whose coverage requires significant cost-sharing have made insulin unaffordable in those households. People with diabetes will have certainty on their maximum cost sharing for their insulin, which will allow them to focus on managing their chronic conditions rather than rationing their insulin. We have this unique circumstance where the companies that develop and provide insulin are saying that they're not the ones increasing the price on their product. It's through the insurance process and through the pharmacy benefit managers that people are seeing these massive increases in the cost of insulin. And so we're trying to put the thumb on the scale a little bit on the side of a cap on the copay and then to let the manufacturers and the insurers work it out behind the scenes. The bill will be a battle between the insurance folks and the pharmacy benefit managers on one end and the American Diabetes Association and the pharmaceutical companies on the other. And so it's been fascinating to navigate that process. She's also working on SB 214, which will allow for Rancho Mission Viejo to continue the use of neighborhood electric vehicles. We think that's good for seniors and good for the environment in that community. They're already utilizing this under a pilot program, and we're based on the data that we've had by legislative studies and others, we think this is a good program that has safety built in. And so we're trying to extend the ability to use those neighborhood electric vehicles in Rancho Mission Viejo in perpetuity. And we've been working with the Orange County Board of Supervisors on that issue. Also important for seniors, she has a bill, SB 668, which would delay the implementation of Proposition 19 that was passed by the voters in 2020. This is in partnership with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. That would just simply delay this from an implementation date of 2021 to 2023. Prop 19 was narrowly approved in November and helped some taxpayers while hurting others. While Prop 19 would expand portability of property tax base year value, allowing homeowners over age 65 more opportunities to move to a replacement home while keeping their prior home's lower tax bill. The downside is this measure has repealed Proposition 58 from 1986 and Proposition 193 from 1996. The loss of those constitutional protections mean that property will be reassessed to market value when it is transferred from parents to children and sometimes from grandparents to grandchildren. The only exception in that ballot measure from 2020 is if the person to whom the property is transferred moves into that property within 1 year and the property is that person's principal residence. However, it's not always possible for family members to quickly relocate, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Senator Bates has heard from many constituents in Orange County and in San Diego County who say that they could be forced into higher taxes to sell their parents' longtime home if they cannot move in fast enough in that 12-month timeline. So we believe this two-year delay would give families an additional time to seek professional advice on how to transfer their properties to children and how that will impact their tax liabilities. And then a final bill she's working on is Senate Bill 627, which has to do with public safety in the coastal hazard zones. You've all read the stories about coastal bluff collapse and sand erosion. And so requiring the Coastal Commission or a local government with a local coastal program to approve the repair, maintenance, or construction of shoreline protective devices in coastal hazard zones within 30 days. This would apply to existing oceanfront homeowners. And it would allow the permitting agency to require the property owner to replenish sand. It would encourage the use of native plant species in the mitigation effort by requiring the Coastal Commission to designate those species and allowing the homeowner to plant those species without a permit. Thousands of beachgoers visit our beaches every year, especially in Orange and San Diego County, and they sit next to these bluffs that are eroding, placing them unknowingly in harm's way. And we've had several incidents where people have been killed by heavy loads of those coastal bluffs falling onto those beaches. In 2019, at Grandview Beach in Encinitas, three people were killed when an oceanfront bluff suddenly collapsed on several individuals. And so what we're trying to do here is to allow homeowners and property owners to make the necessary repairs and to also require them to bring in sand to offset any of those repairs. Our challenge here is the Coastal Commission just almost automatically says no to any government entity other than the Coastal Commission or any private homeowners. And so we're having these erosions and we're not doing anything to mitigate for them. And so we're hopeful to put some pressure on the Coastal Commission to at least bring in some common sense. I want to just cover a few other bills that are important to seniors. And just to give you kind of a reference, February 19th was the last day for the legislature to introduce new bills for the 2021 legislative session. On that day alone, we saw 539 new bills introduced between the two houses. There was a total of 2,369 bills introduced this session between the Senate and the Assembly. Let me just say that again, 2,369 new pieces of legislation. Of those 2,369 bills, there were 1,560 Assembly bills and 809 Senate bills introduced by the deadline. So that's a lot of bills, and everyone's kind of going through them right now. They're going through their first House committee process. And so we're getting our arms around what's out there. But at this point, we know that there's a few bills that might be of interest to seniors and the work that all of you are doing in Orange County. Senate Bill 731 by Senator Ana Caballero is in the Appropriations Committee today. So Senator Bates will see it there. It's going to go to the suspense file because it has a little bit of a fiscal impact. So they'll vote on it officially in a couple of weeks. It creates the position of the Deputy Secretary for Health Information Technology within the California Health and Human Services Agency to serve as a single point of contact for health information technology programs that interact with the state government and to coordinate specified federal agencies. So this is good news. We've talked about telehealth and telemedicine and how it's the tsunami of work is being done in that area and how it's going to help so many people, but we have to make sure we provide equity and fairness. This position can help coordinate those efforts in the different state departments. And so we think that's a good piece of legislation that Senator Bates intends to support that bill. The California Hospital Association writes that the bill provides the framework for statewide solutions that will enable many providers to securely share health information and seeks to create an exchange gateway for state data resources that facilitates information exchange between state resources, healthcare providers, and also establish a state leadership role responsible for coordinating statewide efforts. Another bill of note for seniors is Senate Bill 441 by Senator Hurtado. It's coming to the Appropriations Committee, and we anticipate that Senator Bates will support this bill when it gets to her in the Appropriations Committee. It ensures existing loan repayment and grant programs include students and professionals with training in geriatrics with an emphasis on those practicing in underserved communities. This aligns statute with the governor's proposal to provide an additional, $3 million toward this effort in the state's budget. So you see the legislative process is coming into alignment with the governor's proposal. and his budget documents. So that's encouraging that it's already happening at this point. That bill is supported by the California Assisted Living Association, the California Retired Teachers Association, and the County Welfare Directors Association. And supporters argue that seniors are a growing population, and if the current trends continue, the supply of geriatric care providers will not be enough to meet the demand for those who live with Alzheimer's disease and other conditions. So we see this as a very positive development. Senate Bill 460 by Senator Pan will also come to the Appropriations Committee in a couple of weeks, and we anticipate Senator Bates will support this bill as well. It refines procedures for determining that residents of skilled nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities who lack capacity to provide informed consent for a medical intervention. It also creates the Office of the Patient Representative within the California Department of Aging to train, certify, provide, and oversee patient representatives to protect the rights of those patients in skilled nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities when a medical intervention is prescribed for residents who cannot provide informed consent. And then she did support Senate Bill 48 a couple of weeks ago in the Business and Professions Committee, and it requires for professional training to create dementia-friendly workforces in a variety of areas, and the bill is sponsored by the Alzheimer's Association. And this has to do with continuing education requirements in the medical community. And of course, there's many other bills that will impact seniors, especially in those 2,300 plus bills that I talked about. But it's very important for stakeholders to weigh in on those bills. Supporting, opposing, and trying to make them workable and implementable takes vigilance. And that vigilance is just essential because a lot of these bills sound great. But when you peel back the details, you realize that they couldn't possibly be implemented in some circumstances, or they lack a key ingredient that may not allow Orange County to take advantage of them. And so those are the types of things we're looking for and looking for your help and your larger committee's efforts as well. And so I thank you for the opportunity this morning to represent Senator Bates and speak with you today. I'm happy to answer any questions. And again, 2,000 plus bills. So there's just so many that could impact seniors. And so we just tried to pick a couple that might be of interest to you and kind of give you an update on the positive developments in telehealth and the master plan on aging that was released in January. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. That was a lot of information, a lot of good info for us and things for us to work on. I have a question for you on Senator Bates' bill that you mentioned, SB 732. As we know, for many seniors, the barrier to technology is an economic barrier. And SB 732, as you mentioned, will have vouchers for broadband for school children who qualify for certain meal programs.
Right.
What about vouchers for senior citizens? Because there are also meal nutrition programs that seniors qualify for, and that would be a way to see, you know, to provide access to technology for those seniors who are having economic barriers. So could we add seniors to that?
Probably not in her bill. You're gonna see some of that addressed in, you know, I talked about the $7 billion in one federal, the COVID relief bill from the federal government. And it's gonna talk about subsidies for low-income households. So that's gonna impact seniors. And then the other $20 billion package from the federal government. We think that as you increase deployment, you're gonna see additional subsidies. I talked about a bill to expand or to extend the current tax. We think that that tax will ultimately be converted to address the need on subsidies. Her focus is on build out. That's the $5 billion plus one plus one plus one over the 5 years. Mm-hmm. But we did add the capacity in that first $5 billion to focus on those students during the COVID crisis only. So those subsidies wouldn't be long-term. It would only be to try to immediately get money into those households to take advantage of the existing services. So for instance, in my area, I can choose from Comcast or AT&T. And so the voucher would simply, it wouldn't have a cash value. It would say to that household, if you're on that free and reduced lunch program, you could take that voucher to AT&T or to Comcast. For you, it would be Cox Communications, for instance. Yes, you're absolutely right. Her bill doesn't hit the senior aspect, but we do think as we build out deployment and as the legislature takes on the other bill on extending the existing telephone surcharge, you're going to see other bills that are going to deal with that subsidy issue to try to help senior households. So we think it's going to happen. We don't intend to expand her bill to get there. Her bill is really intended to do build out now. We believe it's a better alternative than trying to do a bond. It's a $10 billion bond. It's really amazing what's happening is we did a meeting the other day with the new state parks director because Senator Bates is on the rules committee and confirms the governor's appointees. And with this potential $26 billion surplus, you all know about the deferred maintenance in our state parks. We asked that director how much they're planning on to deal with deferred maintenance for this year, and do they have a big ask for some of that surplus money? And they said, well, we're only asking for $20 million this year for deferred maintenance. And we asked, well, why so little? And he said, well, we're gonna focus our ask for deferred maintenance on the next statewide bond measure. And so you have all of these governmental entities that are deferring projects for a future bond initiative, be it a school bond, a parks bond, or a broadband bond. And we think that some of this should be used, some of the existing resources should be used rather than paying more, not only to build and then to finance the debt payments on those bonds. So yes, her bill doesn't address the senior subsidy issue. We think it's going to occur with other bills that are moving forward. And so the space we were trying to occupy is build it now and then help these kids for these next few months while we're still facing COVID. And so that subsidy will roll off.
And the vouchers, that is just during COVID.
That's just during COVID.
So when do we say COVID stops? June 15th is the date the governor has provided us. So is it June 15th, all of these COVID benefits then come to an end? Or when is the end date for that?
I wouldn't anticipate that. I think the governor's June 15th date is the date to get the economy back up and running. So to get everyone back in place. But I'm sure you've seen the news stories where in Oakland and in San Diego and in the city of Sacramento, kids aren't going back to school right now.
Right.
And the governor announced last week that he's hopeful that those kids will be back in by next fall. So mm-hmm. for the academic side, it looks like that COVID could run in many of the large urban districts up and down the state could run into next fall. And so we just don't know the answer to that. At this rate, the voucher concept may not get put in place in time because the governor hasn't adopted that model in the budget. And there's no, there doesn't seem to be an appetite to fast track Senator Bates's bill. So we'll see what happens. That may fall out of that bill if it takes too long to get that bill implemented.
Okay,
but her focus is trying to grab some of that surplus money to actually build things now.
No, it's great that there's a recognition of the needs for our school children, but we also need to recognize the needs for seniors. And I know when I've talked to our cable company about any subsidies or reduced rates for seniors during COVID, it was no, but we have reduced rates for school children. Yeah. So, but we want to make sure our seniors are taken care of as well. Are there any other questions for Kevin? I know he's given us a lot of information. Jim Levy.
Yes, the senator introduced a bill, SB 1090, which had to do with the protection device against sea level and beach erosion. You mentioned that she withdrew that last year. And you said she has a new bill that follows that. What's that bill number?
Yeah, let me grab it here for you. Our coastal erosion bill is Senate Bill 627.
627. Thank you.
So we're just trying to provide a little bit of balance there. The Coastal Commission's immediate answer on any shoreline repair or shoreline work is no. And so we're trying to at least require them to take a look at some of these projects.
Yeah, we know that. The Coastal Commission has just said no to almost everything that's been recommended to them. Anyhow, this bill would force them to do certain things, such as the sea level rise, have the walls and things like that, right?
Well, in some cases it would involve sea walls, but we think it's also allowing for the planting of native species plants. It's also what are called toes, which are small sand piles in different parts of the beach to direct ocean flow. There's any number of types of projects that can be implemented, but we really need to figure out how to deal. Erosion is very natural, and so we've got to figure out how to deal with it. And we also need to call attention to it from a safety standpoint. If you walk down some of these beaches, you can see, for instance, at that Grandview beach space where it collapsed and killed three members of a family. Within days, people were right back underneath that bluff. And so we've got to do a better job from the state side and the local government side of making sure people are aware of the risk that they're taking by sitting right underneath those bluffs. So we've just got to provide some balance, and we want to be part of that discussion.
Thank you.
Hey, are there any other questions for Kevin?
Yes.
Larry Kramer.
Yeah, I appreciate all the information you've given us. I think it's been tremendous. The fire hose analogy comes to mind.
Indeed.
Is there any possibility that you could share some of your notes with us?
I'd be happy to. I can send them to you. As I said, you know, with 2,300 plus bills, it's very challenging to try to weed through and pick out key ones that are of note. So
yeah, I was trying to keep some notes, but you're talking faster than I can write. But
I apologize.
Great information, though.
I apologize.
No apology necessary. You had a lot of good information to get in. So if you can send that to me, Kevin, I'll be sure it goes out to the committee. Evelyn, and then Patty.
Mine is more of a compliment, particularly on 473. That's the insulin bill. I have heard of any number of people who actually do monitor or kind of cut back their insulin so that they can make do with their food and other necessities. So what is the likelihood of that proceeding, and about when do you think that would be enacted?
It's going to be heard next Wednesday in the Senate Health Committee, and we're reasonably optimistic, but it's not as I said, it does pitch a battle between some constituencies. And so on one side, you've got the American Diabetes Association and the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, Big Pharma, on one side in support, and you have many of the health plans and what are known as the pharmacy benefit managers in opposition. And so we're trying to work through that. The companies that manufacture these drugs are frustrated because they say our pricing hasn't gone up, and we're getting blamed for the explosion of price levels. And really that's due to the pharmacy benefit manager process. And so it's a dispute, it's been a longstanding dispute, and we're not gonna solve the overall battle between those entities. We're just hoping to solve it in this one specific circumstance, and that's with the availability of insulin, because it's just so essential and impacts so many households. So we're optimistic, but we'll know better when we have the hearing next week in the health committee.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Patty.
I thank you very much for your very thorough report, and I look forward to seeing your notes and cross comparing with what we've been following. I had one question for you on SB 56, Durazno, which appears to be in suspense, and our group has been following it. That's the bill that would allow for Medi-Cal eligibility for all people, regardless of immigration status, especially those over 65. Do you think it's going to just stay in suspense and not rise again? Do you have an opinion on it? And
you know, there's been the legislature and the governor expanded access for undocumented youth a couple of years ago. We anticipate that because the governor is so focused on this, that this will ultimately pass through the legislature at some point. It's a big dollar amount. I don't have the dollar amount in front of me, but it's not insignificant. So any bill that has a cost is going to go to suspense. My instinct is that it comes off of suspense and ultimately makes it to the governor's desk this year.
this year. Okay, thank you.
Hey, any other questions for Kevin? So seeing none, Kevin, you were extremely thorough. We appreciate your time today and also for taking our questions and answering them. And please convey our appreciation to Senator Bates for what she does for Orange County residents. And I'll look forward to getting that email from you with some of these bills on it that then I can share with the rest of the legislature.
What I'll do is I'll send you my notes as prepared, and then you can take which pieces you would like out of it from that standpoint. Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your time today.
Have a great day.
You too, Kevin. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Elaine, for coordinating that. That was a very good presentation. The next item on our agenda is the legislative tracking, but that's kind of the whole focus of our agenda today. So Tony, I'm not sure what you want to discuss with us that we're not going to already go through in greater detail.
Okay, I sent you the legislative report. I've been checking it almost on a daily basis, and so far there is no movement on any of the bills. So that's it.
Okay. Thank you. And is John still here? No, he's gone to another meeting. Okay, so we will skip the CSL caucus and let's go to the new business, which is reviewing the legislations on our tracking sheet for MPA goals 1 and 2. Now, Lita, unfortunately for you, you're the newest member and you're right up on the top, number one. But let me just open this by saying, I asked if when we go through these, if we would look at, if we would give a very brief synopsis of what the legislation intends and an update on its status, as well as in your opinion, if you think it's a strong, moderate, or low interest to the residents of Orange County seniors. So those are kind of the three things it'd be nice to hear on each of these different proposed legislations. The other thing that I just wanted to bring up is that at the SCAC meeting last week, we had a presentation, Elaine presented the draft statement of our priorities that's going to the Board of Supervisors. And it mentions housing, transportation, mental well-being, food nutrition, and technology. So one of the things that was said at the meeting was, are there any specific recommendations that we want to make to the Board of Supervisors? So if there's anything along those lines of a specific recommendation, whether it's to strongly support some provision, also let us know. So Nalita, are you there?
Good afternoon, everyone. Yes, I am here. It might be a little noisy and interrupted. I'm not getting very good internet service. And my notes are in my luggage. Is it possible that I may email my notes to everyone later today?
Sure, that's fine. Okay, so that was for AB 71, the homeless funding, which brings California Home Act, includes provisions targeting older adults and the Expand Home Safe program. Those two, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, all right, great.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's move on to the third one, which is AB 1083. The author is Nazarian and Tony.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, here. Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Yeah, AB 1083 deals with the basic issue of senior affordable housing. And the specific issue there is a nursing pilot program. And the bill proposes to grant funds to use a full-time nurse to work at three senior housing developments in each county. So that's the basic issue. The last action that I found on this was referred to committee on March 4th of this year. So, that's where it is. Orange County is one of the counties mentioned that would get these full-time nurses. So, it seems it would have some positive impact, though I don't think it's like a game changer.
Okay. Can you explain go ahead.
That 1083, that's due to be heard in the Assembly Aging and Long-Term Care Committee tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Okay. Yes, I was just going to ask, what happens when there's sort of no action? Because a couple of the ones that I was following up on, they just kind of, there's nothing happening. And I don't know where you get updates on that. Do you know, Tony?
Yeah, you just, go to the website, legislative information, and click on it. And it just basically tells you it's in, it's just holding in a holding pattern.
Holding, okay.
Limbo. For lack of a better explanation.
Yes. Okay. All right, well, let's move on to SB 591. Elaine, do you want to give us a brief update on that?
Yes, that has been amended. It's set for a hearing tomorrow. And this is the one where senior housing developments or area. So according to law, you cannot discriminate for housing except when it's specifically for seniors. So we have senior communities. So this one would then say, okay, a senior community, we can bring in some intergenerational housing where the senior community would be a minimum of 80% seniors and up to 20% of transition age youth. Transition age is 18 to 24. Thinking there'll be some intergenerational, community there. Also that the transitional age youth would maybe assist seniors. So what I suggest though, is that both anyone who is in Seal Beach or Laguna Woods, that you take this to your legislative analyst in your city and have them take a look at it to see whether or not how this would impact, because that's where our primary cities are that have primarily senior community, to see what the impact is. And also if there's any unintended consequences that I should be aware of. Sherry.
Yes, I was under the impression that you would lose that senior community status if you have people under whatever the age limit is, 60 or 65. I mean, here we have a huge senior community, and when they go to church, when they have other age groups, but most people here would not want children skateboarding up and down the streets and bicycle. It sounds nice, but not where seniors are walking. Yeah. The trip and fall would be bad. Kids throwing balls across the golf course.
I'm not advocating support or opposition. I'm saying it's something that we need to learn more about, but also it specifically refers to transitional age youth, which is 18 to 24. So, again, but I think you want to have your city's legislative analyst take a deeper dive into this to see how it would impact Laguna Woods and also Seal Beach.
When I did that proposal on roommates, they had to be of a certain age or we would lose that senior status.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm most concerned about. I don't want to lose our senior status.
Yeah, and my understanding is that it would keep that, but you would be able to have up to 20%
of the 18 to 24 year olds.
Once you have a few people in there, they'll say, well, they're allowed. How come my kids aren't allowed? Or I will ask what they think of it, but I am not for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just judging from the comments and living here for 20 years, the people here, they like interacting when they're outside. They go they volunteer in schools. It's like a grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
They're much better because you don't have to take care of them.
But I also think that's why there's a specific age when they're saying 18 to 24. Well, and I guess this is something that's been done in other areas of the country, where we've seen reports studies where they have maybe college students who are living with seniors, and there's a beneficial relationship to both. But again, I'm not advocating for or against, but I think Laguna Woods and Seal Beach in particular would want to have your legislative analyst take a look at it.
Okay.
We'll have to take a look.
Great. Thank you. And the next hearing for that is tomorrow then?
Yes.
Okay. And then SB 675, Tony, can you talk to us about that? Tony R.
Okay, 675 has been re-referred to the Senate Governance and Finance. They went and see how much it'll cost and the cost analysis and everything.
Okay, Tony, could you move a little closer to the speaker?
Yes, let me just crank up the volume. Anyway, it's been referred to the Senate Governance and Finance to do an analysis of how much the actual cost would be.
Okay, and this would allow the Board of Supervisors to establish monthly property tax payment systems.
Correct.
So that you spread it out throughout the year rather than.
That's right.
You know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to step away for a second and find a charger because I only have 10% left, battery left. Mingle. Are you mingling? I don't hear any mingling.
Yes.
Hey, you guys. I am having trouble with a connection, so if I disappear.
Okay.
You know, I'm somewhere out there, but I don't know where.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Tony on 675?
Okay. Evelyn?
Yes.
Can I give a report on the other two that I'm...
yes, because you're going to be leaving soon, right?
Huh?
Yes,
no, I'm not leaving. The next one that I had was AB 848, which is the Medi-Cal long-term care personal needs. That means increasing the allowance from $35 to $80 a month for people on the SSI.
I'm sorry, Tony, which one is it?
AB 848.
848.
Correct. The Medi-Cal long-term care personal needs.
Older on.
Yes. Anyway, that one has been referred again to appropriations, which, if memory serves me correct, this bill has been around two, three times, and it seems to always die in appropriations. So, you know. The other one? The other one that I'm following is AB 383, which is the mental health older adults, which with the state would establish with the Department of Health an older adult mental health service administrator to see services for older adults. This bill will be heard tomorrow in the Assembly Health Committee.
Okay, and what's the purpose of the older adult?
It would add a mental health administrator to oversee mental health services for older adults.
Okay, right.
And it's going to be heard in the health committee tomorrow.
Okay. They're going to have a long meeting tomorrow.
Yes. And that's the three that I have.
Okay. So the one 848, that's really disappointing because you say that it's not moving anywhere and yet people
$35 allotments was based back in 1982.
Yes.
And it has not moved ever since the, at 1982, they, you know, the older citizens in the facility get a haircut, get a hair done, whatever.
All but right.
In 2021, they can't even get a package of toiletries for $35.
No, so, I know.
It's been a sore subject. At one time, I was working Medi-Cal for the county of Orange County, and we kept fighting for it, and it would always die in appropriations. And that's just the history of that concept. So,
okay. Well, it says that the fiscal effect is unknown.
So correct.
Why would it die in appropriations if they haven't even figured out what it would cost?
Well, they figured it's scanned in the money assessment, and it would raise the amount, something the amount to $200 to $300 million a year. So, you know, that's, I think that's the stumbling block they have, appropriations.
Okay, well, it is supported by senior legislature, California Retired Americans, California Association of Public Authorities for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the Western Center on Law and Poverty. I mean, this one might be one that we want to pursue.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I said, this has been around for over 10 years. It gets introduced and reintroduced every year, and it goes to appropriation. If it dies, it goes to suspense. So it has a long history of doing that. So, but I'll keep an eye on it.
Okay, thank you.
And that's it for me. Those are the three I'm following.
Okay. All right. That was mostly housing for all ages and stages. At least two of them or three of them were. The next MPA, Health Reimagined, Elizabeth, AB 98, can you speak to that? Are you still here? Elizabeth had to leave. She's in another meeting. There's another meeting going on at the same time. So this is why some people had to leave. Carol, can you speak to AB 279? You're on mute, Carol. But good speech.
That left committee on 414. It was then amended and referred back to the committee. And that is, it makes it, when nursing homes change ownership, that they want to make sure that the nursing care or the supportive services are either the same or better. In other words, they don't want the services to diminish because it changes ownership.
Okay. And that is being heard?
It was amended. Sure. It's back in the committee.
Back in committee. Okay. In the health committee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We did 383. Tony Alavado, 470. Okay. AP 470. Hey.
470. All right. I'm just looking at the most recent status on that. Okay. The bill would declare the intent of the legislature to enact legislation to eliminate the consideration of assets for the purpose of determining Medi-Cal eligibility. Okay, so currently there's an asset test that's required by federal law, and this bill would repeal the asset test to the extent of federal law. And it was amended on April 13th. And on April 14th, which it's funny, I looked I looked at this yesterday. I just looked at it a second ago. It's been re-referred on April 14th now to the Appropriations Committee. So I guess it has some financial impact. So that's where it stands. It's moving moving through the process. So I gather there, there are seniors who have low income and substantial assets, and some people probably would be required to liquidate those assets to continue on in Medi-Cal. And this would, would allow them to be able to keep those assets and still get the Medi-Cal treatment.
Okay, first okay. Three. Okay, thank you. Any questions for Tony on that? Okay, the next one is AB 523 by Nazarian. And it is, pardon? It is in the Health Committee. There's a hearing on the 27th. And this is a program that would actually, or funding that would actually expand an existing COVID program, which is called PACE. So it would provide funding for the telehealth, for enrollment agreements, for adult day healthcare and facility beds, marketing, discharge plans. There is a significant fiscal impact. It has not been evaluated. And I just want to read you the author's comments. It says, according to the author, the flexibilities that have allowed for PACE organizations to respond to the COVID-19 crisis and at the same time provide care to more participants are done under the authority of regulatory waivers responding to the health emergency. So the request is to keep the PACE program going. There are 65 PACE sites across California serving over 12,000 frail seniors. It is supported by everybody and opposed by nobody. And as I said, it is scheduled for a legislative hearing on the 27th in the Health Committee. Any questions about that?
Can I just offer a little clarification? The PACE program itself has been used for about the past 20 years. So it stands for Program All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. During COVID and the quarantine, participants were no longer able to come to the PACE centers. So what this bill is actually asking to impact is the emergency funding that was allocated in order to provide what was called temporary alternative services, where the PACE participants that normally would have come into the center, get their meals, get their medical care, socialization activities, and so forth, they got that at home to the best of everyone's ability, with porch drops, with telephone, telehealth, sending activities home and check-ins. So this funding would provide for longer term, I guess, hybrid services in case people couldn't come back to the PACE center right away, or maybe couldn't come back even after the PACE centers are over, could still receive some of these services at home. So it really is a good thing. And PACE is proven to reduce visits to the emergency department and reduce hospitalizations and reduce skilled nursing admits.
Thank you. And it's kind of supports all of the goals of the master plan for aging. I think this is one that I would strongly recommend that we keep track of this one. Okay, we already talked about Calderon's 848. The next one is AB 849. And that one is in the health committee also. It has been heard by the judiciary committee, and there were 8 ayes and 3 noes. The intent is to kind of fix a loophole or clarify the law about how much a facility would be fined per violation. Do they get fined for each violation or for a series of violations? And that's what this is about. All of the opposing parties are health providers, and all of the supporting parties are senior advocates. I think it's a dispute that's going to be settled in favor of fining per action instead of per each violation. I don't know how important this is to the committee or to Orange County residents. Okay. That was 849. Larry, could you talk to us about AB 911, Nazarian?
Sure. AB 911 and SB 515 below it are basically companion bills between the Assembly and the Senate. And as I read it, this would require the California Department of Aging to establish a long-term services and support benefit task force. They don't have to create a new organization. They can use existing if they want to, but as I read it, this is to look at how people can choose where they want to age, whether they want to age in their home or somewhere else. And this task force would look at that to try to make it possible for you to pick your place to age, if you will. It looks at if you have disabilities and so forth, what do you need in your house in order to stay there? So I think that's what this is scheduled to do. And both bills, AB 911 on April 15th, was referred to the Committee on Human Services, and SB 515 on April 12th, was read for the second time and amended, referred to the Committee on Human Services. So both are moving. And I think these are beneficial bills.
Yes,
I want to stay in my house as long as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. Thank you. I think you're right. Those are pretty important ones. Okay, AB 1054. I looked this one up, and there's no action. There's no analysis. And it is to establish a feeding assistant, somebody to help feed people who cannot feed themselves in the facilities, as I understand it. Does anybody know anything more about it? Okay. And then the next one also has no analysis. That's AB 1234, advanced care planning in the electric in the electronic age. Again, there's no analysis on it. It is in the health committee. There's been no action. And
we have a little information if you like.
Yes, please.
Okay, hang on. I lost the place on my tracking sheet. I'm sorry, it's right here, 1234. The bill would allow an electronic signature to be used on an advanced healthcare directive or a pulsed form. And during COVID, we have had some emergency measures that allowed for this if, for instance, the patient's doctor couldn't be where the patient was to get a pulsed or an advanced directive thoroughly enacted. It would also help enact an e-registry for the pulsed form, and it would require California Health and Human Services to create a statewide electronic pulsed registry system for the purpose of collecting patients' pulsed information received from a healthcare provider and keeping it in a secure cloud and having it be available to the healthcare provider or hospital when required. So disseminating the information to an authorized user with all the protections of HIPAA confidentiality. Let's see, it would allow an electronic representation of the pulsed to suffice. And some other things that was in here. So it would just really expand the opportunity to use the pulsed document and not be fettered by the fact that right now we need to have an actual photocopy or actual paper pulsed in hand in order for it to be actionable.
Okay.
So it'll streamline things. It's a good thing.
Okay. Thank you, Patty. Jim is not here.
I'm here.
Oh, yeah. There you are. Okay. Jim, AB 1300.
Yeah, AB 1300 is a bill that allows residents of residential care facilities for elders to use electronic monitoring devices in their rooms. And it prohibits the entry from operating a skilled nursing facility without first obtaining a license on its own behalf. I have communicated with Gail Raymer, Chief of Staff. I didn't get any response initially, and finally I got something back saying this is actually a spot bill and we aren't currently moving forward on it. I contacted back to her indicating how important this is, and from my experience as a person who calls on these people as an ombudsman, knowing how important it is to stop some of the things that happen in these rooms. And she came back and said, oh, it was a mistake. It's not a spot bill. It's going to be a two-year bill. Now, what that means, I don't know, except she's keeping it on instead of just using it to use it as a replacement if they found something more important. So that's where that stands.
So does this really mean you can put a camera in your room? Is that what that means by electronic monitoring devices?
It means you can put a camera in your room. However, if there's more than two people in that room, you need to have the permission of the second person to mm-hmm. have that camera device there. Mm-hmm. And also it just showed who's coming in and out of the room. One of the amendments should be to put this on the patient's bed or have it on the patient's bed and see if there's anything that is happening to that patient that shouldn't be happening. But the patient has to approve, the resident has to approve having this done. So that's where it stands. It's quite confusing for a while. Initially, it looked like it was just seeing who comes in and out of the room. And then it's sort of changing a little.
Okay.
As it stands right now, I don't think it's being heard.
Okay. Okay, first read on AB 1502, Elaine.
Okay, so AB 1502, which will be known as the Skilled Nursing Facility Ownership and Management Reform Act of 2021. So it was amended on March 22nd, and then March 23rd, it was referred to the Committee on Health. Don't see anything else scheduled for right now. Basically, what this does is that a freestanding skilled nursing facility would need to have its own license. And what it attempts to do is to prevent squatting. Squatting is when new ownership or ownership will come in and then apply for the license. This is they need to have the license before they can take ownership. So, but that's all that I have right now. Like I said, last month it was referred to the Committee on Health and there hasn't been any other further updates.
Okay, thank you. Patty, SB 48, is this the one that, oh yes, this is the one that our speaker was talking about.
Right, it requires 4 hours of specific continuing education for general practitioners and internal medicine physicians, physician's assistants that would get specific dementia training in order to facilitate more accurate and early diagnosis in particular and improve and enhance care for people with cognitive decline. Let's see, right now it is under the third reading is today, so it's still active. And our organizations are really supporting it. It was initially sponsored by the Alzheimer's Association and then Alzheimer's Los Angeles, Alzheimer's Orange County, and Alzheimer's San Diego all wrote letters of support.
Okay. I'm confused by the dementia-friendly workforce, I've got to tell you.
Okay, is that one of mine? I don't think it's one of mine. Yes,
it says requiring professional training to create dementia-friendly workforce.
Well, what is apparent just from my grassroots experience and from some of the studies that have been done is that most people in the community do not know how to interact with someone they encounter who has a cognitive difficulty, especially not in a clinical setting. Some of the worst problems happen to people with dementia when they're in acute care hospital facilities because the staff is not well trained of how to communicate, how to encourage, and how to explain whatever procedures are being performed on that individual. So a dementia-friendly workforce then would require an evidence-based curriculum to educate those who are interacting with people with dementia and to make it, it's rather like, I'm sure you've heard about the age-friendly workforce and age-friendly hospitals and that moving through the Institute of Health. It comes alongside that in alignment to take it a step further, that not only understand the needs of people who are aging and how they're different from another type of patient, but then adds on the specific needs of people with dementia. Now, for example, if you don't tell a person with dementia who you are every time you come in the room, even if you were just there and said, I'm your charge nurse and I'm gonna be taking care of you tonight, they may not know who you are. And so if you start to move their bedding or change their bed position or do something to them or for them, they may react badly because they don't know who you are. So very small incremental changes in the way we interact with someone can avoid very profound agitation.
Okay, thank you. Just clarifying that that's in clinical settings made it all comprehensible to me.
Yes.
Okay. Larry, you have two more, SB 56 and AB 4.
Yeah, and they're closely aligned. There is a subtle difference between the two of them. SB 56 would make Medi-Cal available to those 25 and younger, or 65 and older, regardless of immigration status. It also states that if this is passed, they would still need federal approval. And I have as a status for that one in a suspense file right now, which is, I thought I learned from last year, that means it's not going anywhere right now. Although there was some indication from our speaker earlier that it might go somewhere, but right now it's not going anywhere.
Right, he said he feels like it would ultimately pass.
Yeah, he did. AB4 is a little different in that it would be, everyone is eligible for Medi-Cal regardless of immigration status. So this would also include people between the ages of 25 and 65. And that one right now has been on April 1st, referred to Commission on Appropriations. So that one's still moving.
Okay.
Well, interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah. Okay. SB 256. This is by Pan. It is currently, there's going to be a hearing on April 28th in the Senate Health Committee. And this is a fairly long one, but the bill would establish CalAIM initiative and require the implementation of CalAIM to identify and manage the risks and needs of the Medi-Cal beneficiaries in transitioning and transforming the Medi-Cal program to a more consistent and seamless system. So, I don't have the details on this. I don't understand exactly how they would be implementing and improving the Medi-Cal Act. It's rather extensive. Does anybody have any information on this one? Okay, well, the hearing is on the 28th, so I'll listen in on the hearing, see if I can get a little bit of information on that. Okay, and then there's two more in the Health Reimagined section. It's SB 281 by Dodd. It is in the Senate Appropriations Committee. It passed the Health Committee with 10 ayes and one NVR. I guess that's not voting. No, what's an NVR? Is that like an abstaining or not available? And that one requires individuals who have resided less than 60 consecutive days in an inpatient facility to be eligible for services. Apparently right now it's only 60 and above. So that's it.
Would NVR be no vote recorded?
Yes, that sounds right. Thank you. So this one is in the Appropriations Committee. It doesn't have anything about the estimated cost impact. It has a ton of supporters and nobody's opposed to it. So we'll see how that goes through on through appropriations. And then the last one is SB 648 Hurtado. This is to establishes the Enriched Care Adult Residential Facility Pilot Program for purposes of promoting and sustaining essential residential care facilities. This is having a hearing tomorrow, April 20th. I think that's tomorrow. It does have a fiscal impact. It has two supporters, the California Association of Public Authorities and the California Long-Term Care Ombudsman Association. Any questions about that one?
This one really does deal with homeless and Medicare. I'm going to put this in our follow-up file. And then 281 is in Senate Appropriations Committee also. That's the same one I just read. 281. Oh, no. 648 and 281 are exactly the same status. They're both going to Senate Appropriations. 10 ayes, one no vote recorded. And no opposition on it. Okay, any questions, comments to date? Is John Poynter back? No. All right, I know a lot of you need to leave at 11:15 and it's 11:07.
I'm sorry. I had Assembly Bill 123.
I thought we would just go through the first two categories of
That's a different category
of housing and health. So you are in on which one?
123, Assembly Bill 123. It has to
123, that's caregivers.
It has to do with family leave.
Right. So you're on for next month.
Oh, okay. Well,
okay. So next month we'll do the MPA goals 3, 4, and 5.
Okay. It left the committee and it's in appropriations. So,
okay.
Let's see what happens to it by next month.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So new membership. We have no new members. TAC report. Larry.
Well, the next TAC meeting is June 8th. I made my report from the last one before.
Yes, you did.
I have nothing else to add.
Okay, thank you. Dave, is Dave still here? No. Patty, did you want to give us any information? Is Patty still here? No. Okay, announcements and roundtables. Any announcements?
They're both.
Minute. Right, at this time, members of the public may address the council regarding any items within the subject jurisdiction, provided that no action is taken on off-agenda items unless authorized by law.
Hey, Evelyn, this is Jenna from the county. We did not receive any speaker requests. We do have one attendee attending the meeting this morning. If you would like to speak, you could raise your hand and I can unmute you. All right, I don't see that the attendee is wishing to speak at this time.
Okay, no, neither am I. All right, thank you. Well, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned at 11:10. Hope you have a great week and we'll talk to you next month. Okay, bye.